Bonjour, bonjour, and welcome to another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com, the no-fluff, actionable marketing podcast for marketers, founders, and tech people who are just sick of shady, aggressive marketing. I'm your host, Louis Grenier. In today's episode, you will learn how to build an audience with video. My guest today is the founder and CEO of Wistia, which is the video software for businesses that you probably have heard of a few times before. Recently, what I found to be super interesting is that Wistia turned down the offer to sell the company and instead took $17 million of debt. And you know why? Because they want to run the business their way. So super happy to have my guest on board. He actually loves creative brands, which I do as well, but he also loves disaster movies, which is something I'm curious about. Anyway, Chris Savage, welcome aboard.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
So what's your favorite disaster movie?
Right now, I would say it's San Andreas.
Oh, Jesus.
With The Rock. You know, when you're watching a disaster movie, you kind of, you know what you're getting. It's very like, let's see how terrible they could make this, how over the top they can make this. And I just think that one, you know, it's got everything. It's got helicopters. It's got, you know, a giant fault line that tons of people are living on. It's outrageous. But I think for what it was well done. It was great.
So the criteria for a good disaster movie is it has to be over the top. There has to be helicopters.
There has to be helicopters. Yes.
There has to be tanks.
It's funny. My taste, I've found that like over time, so I majored in film when I was in school and I was really into the films that like made you feel like weird, you know, like stuff that was like totally disjointed storylines that required an enormous amount of analysis. And over time, I do like that stuff, but I found that it's like sometimes it's almost, this would be an extreme way to say it. It's like disaster movies are not meditation, but like you know what you're getting. And yeah, I find it delightful. 2012 is another great one. The Day After Tomorrow is another great one. So, you know, there's not that many great disaster films, but the ones that are out there, I do enjoy.
So we've all heard the same thing, right? Video is taking over the world, right? So we talk about movies, moving on to videos. And is it actually true that video is actually taking over the world, that more and more people watch videos, or is it something that video marketers are telling us to sell their stuff?
Yeah, it's funny as you're saying that, like, definitely something that video marketers, of course, will tell you is that video is taking over the world. I think that entertaining content for that is specific to your interests is taking over the world. So like that could end up being video, and it also can be the right podcast and also can be the right book. But I feel like our culture has gone from, we used to have a culture where the internet was like a small part of it once the internet was formed, and the internet was for nerds. And on the internet, everyone was into something weird, but like out of the internet in our culture, you weren't. And now our culture is the internet. And so everyone's into their weird thing, and everyone has like these things that were tiny niches can be huge opportunities. They can become huge audiences. And so for the right niche, yes, they expect content that is really engaging for them, which they expect videos that are actually engaging and genuine, authentic. They expect podcasts that are like right on the money in terms of like the alignment of their interests. They expect books, blogs. Like I think people expect that the little niche that they're interested in, they will get really engaging stuff within that. So yeah, video is important, but I think storytelling more than anything is like more important. That lends itself really well to video. Right. I would say also, yeah. And video has gotten much easier to create. It's gotten cheaper. The tools have gotten better, much more democratized, which is great. And so we see a lot more video, but it's not like everyone's just walking to work watching videos, you know, like they're listening to podcasts and they're doing everything.
So I'm glad you didn't give me a bullshit answer. I wasn't expecting you to, but, you know, there was a possibility you would say, absolutely, video is everything. And I agree with you. It's only a format. It's only a format, right? The things behind it, the first principles behind video, the engagement, the authenticity, the fact that you can do them more and more cheaply, the fact that people have no time and they need something that really is relevant to them, that all makes sense. So today, together, what we try to do is trying to talk about how to build an audience using video. And hopefully we can get into a step-by-step scenario where maybe we are like trying the taking a fictitious example of a company that is not using video that well and maybe doesn't have a massive audience and maybe trying to figure out how to build an audience this way. So why don't we get started straight away then? Because you are the expert in video marketing for sure. So let's say we are a business that have maybe a decent audience or some sort of an audience and we want to use video. We realize that it might be a good thing, or maybe that's a step that you want to decide whether it's a good thing or not. So how would you advise a business like this to start with video? Like, what is the first step you envision?
I would say the first thing is, do we have a website?
Yes.
Okay. So I think website's probably step one. If you are transacting on the internet, and then I would ask the question like, how many people are finding you? How are they finding you? What's holding them back? Like, I think the thing that video does well is you can tell a story and you can tell it in a linear way that makes something complex more simple. So, you know, 5 years ago, we was kind of when we saw tons of explainer videos popping up. And I think the reason that was the case is that so many companies have so much trouble explaining what it is they even do, like how they differentiate from anybody else. And so the hiring outside firm to come in and say like, this is how, from our perspective, from a 30,000 foot view, this is how we describe what you do. And this is how we would make it clear to others. That's still an opportunity if you're hearing things like, we don't know what you do. If it is clear that people know what you're doing, then I would look across your funnel and say like, are there moments that people are getting stuck where usually a human interjects and they help them, someone get through that part of the funnel? There might be something there, whether it's a demo of your product, it's onboarding, it's education about the space, like whatever the thing is. I would look for opportunities like that because it's, if you haven't been using video, it feels scary from a brand perspective. It's often what I hear is people say, well, yeah, I think we should probably make video, but if we don't make a good one, will it actually just hurt us? And the answer is, if you make a really crappy video, it will hurt you. So you have to be careful. Or you have to find places where you really know what you're talking about and you can make something that is really genuinely engaging that does help someone through the funnel. That's not really, that's like helping to optimize a funnel though. That's not really building an audience. Yeah. So what are we marketing? What are we selling?
So let me go back a bit what you said. So first off, you said, if you don't know what really you're selling, if people come back to you and say it's not super clear, a video is good for that. And it's funny because you've all, like, if you're listening to this podcast right now, you probably can picture those explainer video that Chris is mentioning about, like, those drawings type, cartoony type of thing that everyone used 3 or 4 years ago about explaining with this stupid music in the background. I remember, actually, I did do this exact thing in the first marketing role I had. I actually used Wistia to host it and Powtoon to do it. And and exactly this. So the cliche of explainer video, because we couldn't write it properly on the website. So that's the proper exact way. And then the second thing you talked about the funnel is, if you figure out there are steps that people struggle to, and usually a person has to step up, then it's a good thing to answer that with a video, because it's almost like a human on demand. It's someone helping you.
Yeah.
But it's not exactly what you like to chat about. It's more like how to build an audience from scratch, is it?
Yeah, I think we could chat about all of this. I would say building an audience from scratch or figuring out how to go from renting other people's audiences to having like a larger audience, which knows you, knows your company, knows what you do differently. And they're actually like encouraging others to join your audience versus encouraging people to like buy your product is just a different thing. It's higher in the funnel. It's a little bit more fuzzy. It's a little bit harder to do. But when done, at least when I've seen it done really well, it can be the type of thing that lifts a business enormously. You know, it's not like a 10% improvement on a page. It's like, oh, wow, this can be what all of our marketing activities are around. And I will say it doesn't have to be video. I mean, obviously, we're here on a podcast. Anybody listening to this has found this podcast, is listening to it. And if they like it, they tell other people about it and other people find it. And it's like you've built an audience with audio. And the question I would say is like, is there a way that you can use video that's going to help you grow your audience faster, or is that not something that you need to do? And for some people, they try to build a podcast that doesn't work, and they try to build an audience with video and it does work. So it's kind of like figuring out the right match between your business, your values, what you think you're going to be willing to work on for a long time, what you're going to be persistent at. And if you can figure those things out and match them to what your company needs, then I think you can you can figure out a way to do it.
All right. So let's take a step back. I can see a lot of microphones in the background. Let's take an example that we're selling microphones. Those microphones are super good for video. So it's like a perfect match with Wistia. Wistia offers you the hosting, the analytics, and the tools to capture emails and all of that. Yeah. Microphones for video, they're portable, they're all of that. So let's say we have that and we want to build an audience as you described instead of ranting other people's audience. So how would you go about it?
I would try to figure out what angle do we have with these microphones that is unique that other people aren't talking about or thinking about. And then is there a way, you know, I'd probably guess, like, let's say it's the microphone or they're all like cardioid mics. So it's like very wide range of sound that they're picking up. And people don't realize that like it's much easier to use. And maybe we are automatically balancing the dynamic range when someone speaks. So no one's ever clipping out. And there's a few different things. The question would be like, how do we make people aware of the problems that exist? How do we give them interesting creative solutions? And is there a storyline that aligns with like the mission behind these microphones that we can really market? Like I like to think about it as like, what's the mission that our product helps you accomplish? And now we just need to market that mission. And people who care about accomplishing that thing will care. So in the case of the microphones, it's probably about getting really, really high quality audio. It's probably about capturing, let's say it's about capturing great stories. And so what we want to do is produce a show that is about like capturing the highest quality stories. So we go find storytellers and we record it beautifully with like beautiful audio editing. It just sounds crisp and amazing. And we encourage people to listen to it on their best headphones. And every episode is like an auditory journey of like really interesting sounds that were all recorded with our mics, but we never have to say that. And if people like it and they like that thing and they're audio nerds and they care about this particular thing, they'll tell other people who care about it. And that, and then hopefully you just like, you keep doing it.
So you very naturally broke down this task in small steps and very naturally identified the mission and all of that. So let's take a step back then and try to understand how can someone do that for their business? How can someone do and identify a mission? Because you naturally pointed to that as a fictitious example. How do you advise people to truly understand the mission behind their product? Should they contact their best customers? Should they interview people internally?
Yeah.
How should they do it?
Yes.
Yeah. I think if you don't know, but you have customers, you should contact your best customers. And you should say, what do you think the mission of our business is? What is it we're trying to do? And that happened with us, actually. We were making content to teach people how to use video better. But we weren't really thinking about it. We were just doing it because it was working. You know, we didn't have a big strategic plan. And then we started talking to our customers. And like, well, obviously your mission is to try to make business more human with video and educate people about how to use video really well. It's like, yes, I guess that is what we're doing. And we started doing that, which in our case had very little to do with video hosting, but like it's video related, but it's not about like delivering large files over the internet and encoding videos and analytics. It has nothing to do with that. It's like very different, but it resonated with people who a small fraction of our audience cared about that. So I often look for like, what is the mission that your product helps somebody solve? And your product probably helps solve a very small percentage of the mission if it's done properly, like 5% of the mission. The other 95% should be the things that are like education, philosophy, other relevant tools, people, like a treasure trove of stuff to talk about. And if you figure that out and you build an audience around that whole 100, then the people who care about the 5% that is your product will find it. But you have like an unlimited number of things that you can talk about.
So this is a super important concept because I know from experience that marketers struggle with that because they're afraid that the mission is too big or doesn't really contain the product and the product doesn't contain the mission. Then it feels like we're going too far. Are we diluting what the product does? We must talk about the product all the time. What you're saying is from experience, what you've done with Wistia is that the content that you produce, which I read quite often, could be something like how to set up a cheap video system to record super quality, high quality videos from your office at home, right? And so you don't only teach them on, as you said, how to host the video on your platform, how to check how many people viewed it. You teach them the step beyond before that, which is how do you actually do a nice video to start with, right?
Yeah.
So that's what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, for us, like, you know, one of the interesting things in our space is that everybody wants to use video and everyone's kind of afraid of using it. And so we have to help people get confident getting on camera. And that's hard. But turns out the fact that it's hard is good, because good for us, because there's so many different ways we can try to teach that and help people get comfortable and help them use different gear and help them think about storytelling and all these different things. And so there's just so much stuff that you can write about and make videos about and do interviews about and all this kind of stuff. It's just like an unlimited amount of things. And it was a weird moment for us, because we were just marketing our product and it was working, but it wasn't like growing dramatically. It wasn't until we figured out how to actually talk about the mission that our product helped solve, that was much bigger than our product could solve, that we actually had a shot of like building an audience. And I see that a lot. And it's often like, those are the reasons you might have started your company in the first place or chose to sell a particular product or whatever. And yet, like, we don't talk about that stuff that much. Yeah, it just makes everything easier. You kind of know where you want to go. There's a limited number of things to talk about. You know what your audience is going to care about. And you have to understand their problems that are going to stop them from accomplishing the mission you want to accomplish.
Do you have another example of this difference between what the product does and what your mission entails?
Just like another product and mission?
Seems really simple, the concept a bit more.
Yeah, this is a funny one, but we did a conference for a few years that was really great. And we used to do workshops as a part of it. And we had someone come who was trying to market like helping people solve fertility issues. And he's like, all right, you know, we have this like fertility program. It's about like timing of everything related to that and all these other things. And it's like a system to use and software to track things. And he was having trouble trying to figure out how to market it because how many people were searching for this. And eventually what he realized was that he had to go, and the reason he was doing this and the reason he cared about it was like helping people obviously have children, helping people build the lives they wanted to build, helping people emulate their own families, helping them like with this like very emotional, heady, bigger thing that his fertility software was like a tiny piece of. You know, it was like helping people like live, create their legacy and live on and like live happier lives and reduce stress in marriages and stuff. And so he ended up finding a way for a mission in terms of like helping, I think what he landed on was helping couples build like more lasting relationships, and then solving fertility was like a small part of that. But like when you start thinking about that, there's so many other things you can do. That was like why he got into it in the first place. It was a very emotional thing, obviously. But I've even talked about things like as simple as they have these like little plastic bags that normally like get almonds in. There's this company that sells these bags like that. And it's like, well, what's their mission? Is like to sell bags you could put almonds in, is like, seems like that's not interesting. But if you start going towards like organizing your life and like helping food be more sustainable and reducing, like by making reusable things, reduce the amount of plastics that are being created, suddenly you have something that everyone cares about, or a subset of the world cares about, and they're going to pick your product for that reason. They're going to pay attention for that reason. So it's often just removing from a few steps of where you are to something bigger that people care about, and usually that has like an emotional element to it. And then once you can do that, then I think you can find a mission.
So I can hear listeners in my ear telling me, you know, that's all well and good. This sounds like, on paper, a very good strategy. VCA is doing that extremely successfully. But I'm going to have a tough time convincing myself or convincing my CEO or my manager to go after that. Because it seems like washy-washy marketing type of thing, right? Like, is it actually the right thing to do?
Yeah. I mean, it depends on what kind of risks your business can sustain and how long they can stay focused on like a problem like this. So I would say it shouldn't be the only thing that you're doing. Like, it just like you were talking about before, it should be a balance. Like, I would look at this as more, if you were to categorize some of your efforts as like brand marketing efforts versus product marketing efforts, I would throw this more in the brand marketing side and help people see other ways that it can be beneficial. One of the things that we've seen is when we actually layer on risk onto a project, if we have enough different ways that the project could work, it becomes incredibly easy to do, even though it's not particularly measurable. So we did a project last year, which was called 110-100, where we had worked with this video agency in LA, Sandwich Video, and they created three ads for us for Soapbox, which is one of our products that helps you make videos, one with a $1,000 budget, one with a $10,000 budget, one with a $100,000 budget. So $111,000. And it was as if a team was building it internally. So it was like all the production costs that you would have if you did it internally. And then we documented this and created a 4-part series where you could watch the whole thing. When we decided to do that project, a significant investment to decide to do these ads. We'd never spent this much money on ads or videos like this. And then we thought, okay, well, if we document the behind the scenes of this, then at the very least, even if the ads don't work, the concept doesn't hit, maybe we can teach people some of the stuff that we learned behind the scenes. So we started like documenting it. And then we thought, well, the video team is going to go out and they're going to see how Sandwich works. So they're probably going to learn some stuff from them. So it's kind of learning and development for that team. So if the other two things fail, at least they got that learning and development. And then we decided the way we'd release it is by just releasing the ads first and then releasing the documentary series. And so we thought maybe even the story of just the ads themselves would be interesting. So we end up with like 6 different ways that this project could work. And if one of the 6 really returned, it would probably be worth it. And then the cool thing was, in that case, we released the ads by themselves and people got excited just about that, the concept. And there was like a lot of chatter and it kind of took off. And so suddenly we're like, wow, I think this project was worthwhile, which then gave us more confidence to take more risks going bigger with the other elements of the project. And so by itself, with only one risk, be really hard to pull off. But by having the other elements to it, it made it much easier to stomach the risk. And then the upside was also higher and it ended up, you know, we ended up being unbelievably happy with how it turned out. And I think if we not layered on all those levels of risk, I don't know that we even could have done it. And we're a company that does this all the time.
Yeah. So as you're the CEO of Wistia, right? So you're very well placed to answer this question. As the CEO, this is the type of things you want to know. Like, let's say you have a project that someone proposed to you. You want to know, okay, what's the risk, but also what's the potential reward? And more importantly,
yes,
could we have multiple rewards? If we hit the jackpot, yes, we can have 6. Right. So that's what you like to see. And I assume
I love that. Yes.
Others would like to see that. Other CEOs, other managers.
Yes. And I would say also just this idea of building an audience and trying to market a mission going a little bit up the funnel. The other reason why that's an exciting idea is that usually what happens in marketing, in my experience, is that you find a channel and you find some sponsorship for a podcast and you do it. And you try another podcast, it doesn't work as well. You try another one, it doesn't work as well. You find one more, it kind of works. So you've got 2 podcasts working, maybe 3 that aren't. How do you scale it? Like if they're coming in and customers come in, how do you scale it? It's really tough unless one of your podcasts is growing dramatically, which is great. So in this, at least in this type of scenario, it's a longer term investment. But if you can end up building your own audience and you can own it, then you can see the signs of like, well, this might not be a 2x thing if it works. This could be a 100x thing or a 1000x thing, but it's going to take a long time. That's okay if you can see progress. That's one of the best things you could possibly invest in. And so it's actually trying to figure out along the way, what are the steps you're taking so that each time you take a step, if it works out, great. And if it doesn't work out, you hopefully learn something and you can keep moving forward.
That's a fantastic way to talk about like finding your mission, because that was where we were at the start. So for this fictitious microphone company, you talked about identifying a mission that is bigger than a product and just taking some risk with it and going for it 100%, which is for you probably one of the best ways to build an audience from scratch. So how do you see then video to be part of this journey potentially, like for this microphone?
Yeah, so what I'm seeing is that expectations are shifting where if I'm on YouTube, I will expect to see on YouTube things that are probably professionally created, clips from shows that I like, individual people who have built up a presence, content from companies that's totally relevant, and it's all zeroed in on what my interests are. And so from a viewer's perspective, I kind of expect that in however I can consume content in an entertaining way, whether it's video or audio or reading, I expect that I'll be able to find things that are related to my interests. And so for video, I would say in the microphone company case, you need to figure out like, what are the stories and things that audio nerds care about who would be the people who are buying your microphones? And what are they not getting in the other places where they're hanging out? And So I would probably look at creating shows that, and just like a media company, I would think, like, let's make a show. How many episodes do we need to make before we figure out if it's going to work? How important is it that those episodes live on my site versus living on social versus being on everything at once? And try to figure out a strategy that is like, if you're trying to sell microphones, you probably want the show living on your site. We probably want it syndicated to the social platforms to try to bring people back to the site. And so I would just start looking for concepts that are like, do you interview like the best audio mixers out there? Do you find people who are interested in using the same tools that are used on films? Do you like, I would go down a list of different types of shows and concepts you could create. And then I'd try to figure out how to vet them. And just like, it would be complementary to what I was doing in podcasting and complementary to what I was doing in blogging and book writing and all those types of things.
How do you do this when it comes to like picking up the show? And then, yes, you mentioned the difference between whether you need to host it on your website, whether you should host it on YouTube first. And you quickly chose for the Microsoft the microphone company that's selling stuff on their website, it's better if the video would be on their website.
If they're trying to sell microphones, I think the question is like, it depends on how you're trying to justify what you're doing. So if your boss is saying, we need to sell more microphones, I don't want to do long-term investments, then you have to figure out a way to get more traffic to your website where people are going to see the microphone and they're going to buy it. And if you can get people sharing things on your website, that is going to tend to be the best way to do that. If you can be in a spot where it's like, okay, that's not what we're trying to do, we're just trying to build up an audience, then you can maybe start on other platforms. And I would look at the platforms and try to figure out like, how can you have a unique opinion on for the audience that cares about this stuff on that platform? So sometimes it makes sense to start on your site and sometimes it doesn't. It kind of depends on the company, where they're at, how much risk tolerance they have, and what their goals are.
So it sounds like if it's a short-term thing, it's really close to the money, really close to revenue. It sounds like, and your website is the source of revenue. Sounds like video is a good place to start when it, hosting on the website is a good place to start hosting videos on your website. But if it's a more long-term investment, if your company is more of the risk-taking side and they want to build an audience first, they understand the long-term effect of being an audience for people to buy stuff, then it sounds like it's probably a good idea to start, as you said, top of the funnel, start a show and all of that, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the question you have to ask yourself is, let's say you have 30,000 views per episode or something, what will happen? Like, because someone will ask you that question. If you have 30,000, great, you have a show and there's 30,000 views per episode. What's happening? Like, what are they doing? You got to have something that's either like the engagement is really high. So there's like a lot of comments and likes and people are sharing it on social. There's like, they're watching other videos or you're going to be asked that question. And so I think that's a good thing to try to evaluate. And then the other thing is, if you have an audience that already exists, like you already have an email list, you have people who are already like paying attention to your blog, it's obviously going to be easier to get those people don't need to go to someone else's platform to see your content. You can have them on your own, like on your own website in the first place. So I kind of think of it as like people who have made it into your audience and they care about what you're doing, they'll happily go to your website to watch something or read something or learn something. But if they have not, if you don't have that level of trust yet, you have to go higher in the funnel. Like you have to go searching higher in the funnel and figure out a way to build your own slice of the audience.
So how do you pick up those metrics? Because you said could be engagement. So it could be success, could look like comments, people sharing, could also be but potentially people signing up after watching the video, or it could be brand awareness, how many people search for your brand, So how do you advise people to pick those metrics, especially when it comes to talking to you as a CEO, talking to a manager, to say, hey, this is what we want to try?
I say try to pick the metrics up front, because that is where, if you can get someone to agree up front and say, like, we're looking to increase brand searches, to take your example. Great thing to try to increase. Pretty good, pretty clear, I would say. Someone is searching for your company. They've heard of it. They probably at least know, they've decided they're probably not planning on wasting their time on your site. There's probably some reason why they want to go. Get people to agree to that up front. If we could get brand search up this much, would that be good? And everyone would say, yes, It's like, all right, we're not going to care about conversions to paid. We're not going to, that's not what we're looking to do. Just looking at brand search. Yes. Okay. Do it. The key, I think, is doing it up front. The problem I run into is like when I've seen many times is when you don't do it up front, you come back with the results and they'll have a list of like, these are all the numbers that it moved. And everyone goes to like, well, how many deals did it get us? Like how many customers? At some point, someone's going to say that because you want to see how much money you put in, how much you get out. And if you weren't clear about the metrics up front, then you're likely, especially a lot of this stuff that's longer term, like it's harder to track the connection to the customer. You're likely to have people saying like, this is not working. And you're like, well, I think it's working. Look at all this engagement. And like, yeah, no, like that's you didn't know that that was going to happen. So it's like, that's your nice excuse for why we should keep doing it versus saying up front, the most important thing we need is engagement. No one's talking about our brand. We need people searching for the brand. The proxy before searching for the brand is going to be views. The proxy before that is going to be percentage viewed. The proxy before that is going to be number of likes. And we're going to look at like how much we spent to promote this and how many people watched it. That's going to be success. And if we get customers, great. And then you go back, you get smaller customers. Everyone's delighted because that wasn't the intention. The intention was to build that long-term audience. And I think it's that framing up front. And it really helps people know that, because even if you're wrong, which you're likely to be if you're trying new stuff all the time, at least if you're thinking about it up front and measuring those things and asking those questions, it just makes it so much easier to keep investing.
I've made this mistake so many times. I made this mistake recently, not being able to set up the expectations from the start. And exactly what you described happened, where you don't set the expectations. And so leadership was expecting something completely different in their head. There was no clarity in my head compared to their head. And you basically end up, I basically end up trying to find excuses and say, well, actually it worked. If you look at this metric, it kind of worked. But yeah, that wasn't what we expected. So this is absolutely true when it comes to trying to come up with any projects, setting up the expectation up front, having one single metric that matters, right? One thing that matters the most for you. And so out of curiosity for the 111 budget campaign, what was the metric that you started with? What was the one metric that matters the most for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. We, from the beginning, we wanted to see engaged views. So that was like, we had and this is for the docuseries part of it. So we basically had like a goal that was like looking at the number of views that of the docuseries on our site. And then we had clips and a trailer of it that we put on YouTube, Facebook, and we used it as advertising on Instagram and a bunch of different things. So we want to know total time spent with the brand and the total amount of engaged views. That was like the key metric that we were looking for. Then we had some other metrics that were at like additional, but were not the key ones. So it was like, there's going to be a moment when we were promoting the trailer before the series came out. How many emails do we think that people would give us to who are excited about seeing the actual thing? And then the effectiveness of the ads, we had like a cost per install that we were looking at for like, if you installed Soapbox, what was our expected amount of that we would spend there? So we had like three different budgets for the same campaign, all with different metrics, but the main one was that engaged view one.
How did you define engaged view? Was it someone who stayed more than a minute? What was it?
Yeah, I think we said it was someone who spent more than 2 minutes. And it was really interesting because the mix of how that happened was very different. So for the trailers and the ads themselves, there was three ads, totaled about 6 minutes, 5 minutes or so. So if you watched all three ads, you were definitely engaged. Trailer was like 2 minutes long. So it was about a trailer view. And then the actual series was an hour and 42 minutes. So like we thought 2 minutes of that would still be good. The interesting thing was that I think it was about like 6 or 7. If you made it 6 or 7 minutes into the docuseries, like 75% of people watched the whole thing. It was crazy. And I think it was also because for us, it was very different than types of content we've made before. But because there was a trailer where you could get the like high level on this, you could go read a blog post, you could see specific examples about this content. The only people who were going to watch this thing all the way through are the people who really wanted to see the behind the scenes. They really want to understand the creative process and the differences between them. And so once that happened, if you got in there, it was just really interesting, dropped, and then it just stuck. People stuck with it through the whole thing, which meant from a brand hours and impact, it was by far the most effective thing we've ever done.
Well, but thanks for sharing all of those insights. Really appreciate it. So if we go back to the problem we're trying to solve here, which is building an audience with video, is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, I would say figure out how to market a mission, figure out how to go up the funnel and think about metrics you can use to help, like, help leadership understand the risks that you're taking. And then figure out a way to put yourself in a position where you're taking risks and you can set up, like, is it X number of episodes or X amount of time spent with the brand or whatever that's going to help us? Like, if you all agree that if we do this, we should keep going forward with it. I think in terms of how the videos are created, you can do this inside your company or you can find an agency that will help you. But the key thing is, like, finding someone who's continuing to work with you. Like, you need someone to be iterating on the process. Just like I'm sure when you've done this podcast, you figure out different tips around, like, how things should be recorded, what types of questions you should ask people who are on the podcast, ways you should talk about on social. Like, you're iterating over time and getting more effective over time, hopefully as the audience is growing. So you're getting more effective as the audience is growing, which helps the audience grow faster. So over time, you end up building this bigger and bigger thing. You just have to do the same thing with video. But to do that, you have to put yourself in a position where you have the budget or the time or the studio or the people. You have to figure out a way to solve the production. And actually, we're also seeing people who are solving this in a way where they're making it much cheaper to produce episodes than anyone ever thought. So ProfitWell.com is doing a fantastic job of this. They have, I think, 3 different video shows at this point. They all live on their site. They all syndicate everywhere. They're really marketing themselves like a media company. And they'll shoot 10 episodes in a day for something. So it's the same setup. They have producers doing the research and pulling in what the episodes are going to be about. And when you shoot 10 episodes in a day with the same talent, it's a lot cheaper to do. It means the threshold of success that you need to hit is a lot lower. And most people would never expect you could even possibly do that. But with the right planning, pre-work, you can actually make it happen. And they do really engaging stuff. So I think they're a great example of someone to look at for a company that's, like, selling business analytics software. Like, doesn't seem... It's like it would be super engaging. They're building an audience pretty quickly doing that.
And so it goes back to the mission thing, right? They sell, as you said, business analytics software. They're also consultants when it comes to churn, like identifying why people churn and how to help subscription companies do better. So if I remember well, they have one show about tearing down pricing pages. I think they have another show that they started, which is more interview-based. They interview founders or marketers. And then there's a third one. You mentioned 3, but those other two.
Yeah, there's like the ProfitWell report, pricing page teardown. So that's teardown pricing pages. ProfitWell report is like data that they see from across their customer base on churn and things of that nature. They have Protect the Hustle, which is like an interview series that's like a higher budget one that's designed to be like a 40-minute video that they also use as an audio podcast. And they have one called Subscription 60, which I think is a 60-second show about subscription businesses. I'm actually not sure of that one just came out. I'm not sure of the angle of that one relative to the others. But by having multiple shows, actually one of the interesting things that they're doing is they can talk about, you build up one audience and then you talk about the next show on the first show. And that makes it easier to build a second show. And then you talk about the third show and the first two and you layer them and it makes it easier to grow all of them.
So you said something a few times on this podcast, I want to ask you more detail about it. You said they basically market themselves like a media company. What do you mean exactly? Like, what's the difference between a media company, the way they would market themselves, compared to a traditional SaaS company?
Yeah. Media company treats the content as a product. So they, just like you can, if you have a great product, you can market it forever. If you have great content, you can keep marketing it. And they think about, like, the analysis, the demographics, the promotion, the cross promotion, retargeting to existing audiences. It's just a different way of thinking about it. The closest example I can give you for us is back to the 1-10 100 stuff. We made a trailer around the series. We promoted the trailer and we had other, like, things promoting the, not just the trailer promoting the series, but things promoting the trailer. And so it's like, if you treat it like the content is a product, and it's a valuable product, it's worthy of your time, people perceive it like that and they're willing to think, like, you know, I should take some time to watch this thing. So it's how HBO just started promoting the final season of Game of Thrones. And they had a teaser a month ago that was like basically a 10-15 second thing. They have like a 30-second one that just came out and they're going to keep promoting Game of Thrones and try to get everyone talking about it. and anticipating it and getting ready to watch 5 hours of content. And that's a big commitment, but they think if you commit to that, you'll be so delighted through, if you care about that type of content, you'll be so delighted by that. You'll tell other people about it. They'll have a big success in their hands. More people buy HBO subscriptions. Boom. Like, it'll help them get the most out of that series.
So that's probably a nice tip for if you're listening right now, is to be influenced by those actual media company promoting multi-million dollars shows. And how exactly did you do it? As you said, Chris, a 15-second trailer followed by a 30-second one followed by a minute one. Like, they just build up commitment. They build up expectation. Yeah. They send dates and teasers. Sometimes they wouldn't even start with a video. Most of the time, they would start to leak one picture of the fucking movie.
Yes.
And you don't really know who's, you know, so they really play on that. And as you said,
they
treat their content like a product.
Yeah. And I think that they're willing to have it not work too. They just know you have to do it that way. So they do that. And then the movie ends up being terrible. I mean, we started by talking about San Andreas. I love it. Not everyone loves San Andreas. Like I can tell you, they promoted that thing like crazy. And it, for them, it's like, okay, if it flops, it's a hits-based business. And that's what happens when you have unlimited entertainment options available. It's a hits-based business, unlimited entertainment options available. They try to stick out their stuff enough and make it obvious enough that you should take the time and consider watching it. But you don't have to do that for everything. But like, if you know you have a hit, you should definitely do that. And so that's also the other thing, I think, is you build up confidence and you are like, actually, this is a really engaging episode. This is really different. You're more confident with how you promote it. People perceive it as being more worthy of their time. And I think you can make things that are engaging and entertaining enough that someone will listen to it or watch it instead of watching Netflix, instead of going to the theater. Like, they will pick it for that reason. It's just got to be on the nose to the niche that cares about it.
Yeah, and that's one of the core principles of marketing, right? Don't try to please everyone. Like, pick a very small niche. If you can really nail the content for them and speak to them and feel like they are really like super engaged with it, then yes, you will be able to compete with Netflix. But if you're trying to compete with big companies and trying to reach all marketers in the world, it's probably going to fail. To repeat what you said, there's so many interesting things. I'm going to try to do justice to all the stuff you said. It's to really understand your mission first, that is bigger than the product. When you want to sell a project like that, let's say you have an idea for a show, always try to set expectations prior to starting it with one metric that really matters to you and to your CEO, to your manager. And advertising yourself or treating this content like a product, like a media company would do, allows you to really maybe have, very much like they do in TV shows where they have a pilot episode, right? They start to see whether that connects with people, very much like that. You want to see whether after 6 episodes or whatever it is it actually reaching the metric? And if it does, if it is, then happy days, let's keep going. Those are definitely all the steps I didn't do, Chris, one year ago when I launched something that just, yeah. And so I can recognize my own mistake in that. So I appreciate you going through all of that. Did we forget anything on this? Do you want to talk about something else on the building an audience side?
No, I think those are the key things. I mean, obviously, there's like lots of hard little things in there that when you face them, you know, you're looking at lots of problems that are like, I have no idea how I'm going to do this. I feel terrified, you know, taking this risk or pushing this way. And I would just say that usually that's a good sign that you're pushing on the right stuff. You know, marketing is a creative discipline more so than ever, right? And gotta be a little scared or it's probably not going to work. So that's also personally what makes it, I find, incredibly engaging and fun. But yeah, I think it's like getting in tune with that and like finding that feeling of like, all right, this feels a little scary, but it feels exciting. Like, let's give it a shot.
It's funny because that's what I say to my team sometimes. I tell them, you know, if you don't have those butterflies in your stomach before you launch something, then it's just not risky enough. It's not going to touch on the emotions that you want to touch, right? It's too safe. And it's a good sign. Obviously, you don't want to go too overboard, but I agree with you definitely. Like, when you feel those butterflies, when you know it, you're like, I don't know, should I press the button or not? It's usually a good sign.
Yes. Yes.
This is what happened with this podcast. At first, I was like very scared. With this, the name of it and all of it, I was like, oh my God. Yeah. Like, but that's what people like. they either love it or hate it. Exactly.
I mean, it's also like people undervalue failure in terms of like, if you try something and it doesn't work and you're transparent about it and you can share anything about what you learned, people appreciate that because other people get to learn with you. So it's like, it mitigates a lot of the risk. But you have to say, I tried this. It didn't work. We wasted this money. We wasted this time. Didn't connect. But if you actually tell that story, that's usually engaging too. So,
agreed. I always ask a few questions before the end of the show. The first one being, what do you think marketers should learn today that will help them in the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years?
I would say storytelling is not going away. It's becoming more important, telling great stories. A great story needs tension. It needs emotion. It needs passion. Like, I would try to hone in on, like, how can you figure out how to become a better storyteller? That'll be true forever in marketing. And it works across like every tactic.
And maybe on the back of that, have you come across any resources? Maybe you've written about it on the blog. I know you have, but like any resources to learn about storytelling that you'd recommend listeners?
What is the best resource on storytelling? I haven't come across anything that is like the best. I just try to consume a lot and like take a step back and ask why I think it's good. There's this book I love called Masters of Doom that's about the two guys who founded Doom, which became the Quake engine for those video game nerds out there. And it's kind of a crazy story of like a partnership, a tiny team doing huge things, growing an enormous amount, how important it was for a tiny team to get together, all the shit that went down, why it wasn't good. And I think it's a good example of like a story well told about like the right niche thing. I think you just have to consume a lot of content and ask yourself like, why is this good and why is it not? And there's a million different ways to tell stories. You have to find a way that you're passionate about it and that connects with you and to the point we were saying before, like helps you get the right butterflies.
helps you get the right butterflies. That sounds like a show. What it reminds me of, what you said about storytelling, is to try to reverse engineer good stories that you see. And I wouldn't recommend to read a book about storytelling. I'd recommend to read books of stories that are just phenomenal, like true crime stories or like fiction. Usually you have top-notch storytellers, people who are able to grasp your emotions, your heart, like to really make you wonder what the fuck is going to happen next. And if you reverse engineer how they do it, yes, it takes time. It's actually not that complex. It's always loops, open loops, closed loops, building tension, releasing tension. The more you do it, the better. And I personally feel the reason why this podcast has been running for a long time is your episode is number 103 now, I think, if I recall, is because this is just linked to one of my strengths, what I enjoy doing, right? So this is why I feel doing storytelling over video, over podcast, over audio is easier for me, but some others might find that writing is something that is better for them. But I would definitely recommend people to double down on their strength when it comes to doing storytelling, because it's you can't just do any type of format, right? You have to kind of nail that, right?
I agree with you completely.
So outside of those, what would be the top three resources you would recommend people listening? Could be anything, like a podcast, a book, conference, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that has been really impactful for me, a lot of it has been like the psychology of like how you run a business and how you figure out what you want to build. Books like Good to Great by Jim Collins was like huge, and I think about it a lot. And The Score Takes Care of Itself by Bill Walsh was a really good one. That's like a classic tech thing that's discussed. This like sounds like a cop-out answer, but I honestly feel like almost I've been more influenced by watching great stories, talking to other people about why they're great, spending time on them, and a lot of the stuff that we're faced with today, a lot of the challenges are the same challenges everyone's always faced, right? Like there are a million great companies and great marketing campaigns that have been done and forgotten. And they were done at a time with no data and just people trusting their ideas and taking risks and talking to customers. And like, I would go back, like Ogilvy on Advertising is really good. And it's part of it that's so cool is you read these like these incredible ads that are like have a ton of text, like the opposite of what you think an ad should be. And it's just a compelling story about like the VW bug. And you're like, what the hell? Why is it so good? I don't get it. And like, how do they measure that? How many magazines did they put in that? And like, how much money do they spend? Like, I think it's go to the past. Like it's all storytelling has always been the key. And I think it's back to what you were just saying, figure out a way to get confident about it. So like find the resources that are relevant for you that help you do that.
Thanks for that. Chris, I didn't comment on your last name because it's pretty good last name, I have to say. Where can people connect with you and learn more from you?
So yeah, on Twitter at csavage, I'm trying to tweet a little bit more, share more about the behind the scenes of Wistia. I also have a blog that I update probably monthly, savagethoughts.com. And, you know, we also, a lot of the Wistia stories are on wistia.com. So the probably the most proud one from last year was the story about why we decided to raise the debt, which was scary and exciting and was great. I'm so good to get it, so glad to get it out there. But yeah, those are the spots.
Well, Chris, once again, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's it for another episode of EveryoneHatesMarketers.com. And this is the moment where I tell you to subscribe to our email list. So before you leave and go to another podcast or listen to another episode, I don't treat email list the way people usually treat their email list. I really treat that as a one-to-one conversation. So I'm going to send you very short and personal emails every 2 weeks, I would say. I'll inform you of guests in advance. I'll share with you my numbers and how many listens we get. And I'll also ask you for your feedback in terms of the questions we can ask future guests. And perhaps I can also have you on the show someday. So don't be afraid to subscribe. I'm not going to spam you. And you can always unsubscribe for sure if you wish. The second thing we need from you is your harsh and honest feedback. We know that this show is not perfect yet and we always can improve. So you can send us your email at feedback@everyonehatesmarketers.com. Good or bad, please feel free to send me an email. And the last thing I'd like from you is that if you did like the episode, please share it to your friends, your colleagues, or whoever might like it. And also please review it on iTunes or another service that you might use to listen to your podcast. Because if you leave us a 5-star review, it means that more people will be likely to listen and we can spread the word quicker. So thank you so much once again and au revoir.